I'm Trevor Allred, and this is the 1888 Center podcast. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to storytelling. Through creative collaboration, our programs are designed to provide tools for community innovation. This episode was produced at 1888 Center, located in the historic district of Old Town Orange, California.
Tonight. I am your host. My name is Sara Guerrero. You can call me Sarah. And this is my first time being here with 1888 Center. And I'm really excited to be a host and will eventually be reading something of my own. Delighted to be hosting the culminating roadshow. So there's been a series, and tonight is the culminating reading, or the culminating event. So that's really, really exciting. So again, thank you, 1888 Center, for being a space supporting storytelling. That's exciting here in Orange County. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. And of course, we want to thank the Roadshow, right? That's exciting, this series. And of course, a great shout out to Brew Sessions Live, right? They'll be recording tonight, right? Woo! So you're all recorded. And of course, Contra Coffee and Tea, right? I tried their dirty horchata. It was dirty and it was great. So again, the opportunity to storytell, right? Especially in this time, how pertinent it is to tell your story or hear stories, right? And collect them and write them and share them. And how stories can transform us, change minds, create conversation, entertain, make us laugh, make us cry. And if you don't already write, I encourage you to write. I encourage you to tell others to write and document their stories. Anyhow, I can talk all about stories, but more importantly, let's hear the stories. And I would love to bring up our moderator for tonight, Eric Morago. Eric Morago, let me tell you a little bit about Eric. Eric is a 2-time Pushcart Prize nominated poet who believes performance carries as much importance on the page as it does off. Currently, he hosts a monthly reading series, teaches writing workshops, and serves as a publisher and editor-in-chief of Moontide Press. Nice, very nice. Eric is the author of What We Ache For, Moontide Press, and Feasting on Sky, Paper Plane Pilots. He has an MFA in creative writing from California State University, Long Beach, woo-woo, and lives in Los Angeles, California. Let me introduce to you Eric.
Anyhow, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for having me. So I'm your moderator for the evening. My job is to moderate. I will be bringing up each individual to read, and we'll also... You're not grabbing my butt, are you? Okay. And also, we'll be doing a brief Q&A with the Spotlight readers. They do not know the questions that I'm going to ask, so that will be fun. That said, there's a lot of names here that I do not recognize. If I mispronounce your name, I am terribly sorry, but in all fairness, Trevor called me Nick Morago, who is my dead brother. So that was awkward. I heard the name Nick Morago, and I was like, what? But that's okay. So I don't think I can do worse than that, hopefully, tonight for you guys. Happy birthday, Trevor. That said, I am going to bring up your first writer and reader of the evening, Shelley Armenta, everybody. Give it up for Shelley.
So this is why I write and my passion behind it. A writer's purpose, I discovered at a young age, is to stay behind while everyone else moves forward and to find the words that allow their head to nod and say me too. and that is hard, messy, beautiful work. I first learned this as a little girl, huddled and hiding in my closet with a flashlight and a tattered copy of A Little Princess. I was trained by my family from an early age that reality was pain and fear and that there was no one to count on. So much like Matilda, but unfortunately minus the telekinesis, I turned to books to keep me company and make me feel safe. Eventually, the librarian at the local library branch let me in on a secret that changed my life forever. There were people, writers she called them, that made a living creating stories and safe places for others in the pages of a book. That was the moment I decided that come hell or high water, I was going to be a writer, no matter what that looked like. So I started writing. Good words, bad words, words I never wanted to see again, words that helped me figure out who I am. Growing up in the environment that I did, I was told at every turn that I wasn't worthy of having a voice. But words were the vessel that showed me not only did I have a voice, but I had a lot to say. This writing life is much harder and messier than it seems, but it is so worth it. All I know is that I have thoughts that keep me up every single night, dreams that are so tangible, they anxiously beg at the door of my heart. I stare too long at other people because I want to try to pocket their every mannerism, and I commit them to memory. I resist the urge to clutch the barista and tell her that she is beautiful and lovely and valid. I cry during commercials, I cry during TV shows, I cry during movies, and I can even be moved to tears by a well-choreographed play on the football field. I don't want to carry the world on my shoulders. Ooh. But my family watches me daily, picking up that big globe and hoisting it up on me from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. I fight too hard. I claw too hard to reach the unreachable. I haven't been able to think in single digits since I was the age of 8 because I just kept thinking, but this should change the world. This could change the world. Despite the daily battles I face and in spite of the naysayers who don't believe in the power of the written word, I get up and I show up every day, balancing that crazy globe and documenting every moment because this writing life should change the world. Writing can change the world.
Thank you, Shelley. We're blessed to be in a room full of writers, and it's one thing to be a writer, but it's another thing to be a reader. So thank you for reading, sharing your words with everybody today, and for everyone who's going to get up here and read. Sometimes it's challenging, so it takes a lot of courage to get up here in front of an audience and share your words. So we applaud everybody for that tonight. All right, this brings us to our first spotlight reader of the evening. I'm going to say their name, read their bio, and I ask that they come up on stage, and I'm going to ask them a couple questions. All right. Faseo Adie. He is the former poetry editor of 14 Hills, a former co-curator of the Velrogue Graduate Reading Series. His chapbook, Blackfish, was a finalist for the 2015 Best Prize Chapbook Contest under Big Lux. He's the author of Cradles under Nomadic Press. He has poems published in Noble, Gas Quarterly, Nailed Magazine, Print Oriented Bastards, that's a good name, This Magazine, and others. Please welcome Faseo to the stage, everybody. All right, so coming up for questions for poets is pretty easy for me, being a poet myself. So I'm gonna ask you something. If somebody says to you, you know, what do you do? Do you feel more inclined to say you are a poet or that you write poetry, and why?
I think I just say that I'm a writer.
Okay.
Not to like, you know, hide from
the shame.
Poetry. Yeah, not
yeah,
to be ashamed.
I get it, yeah.
Not to, you know. I think sometimes like the genres and groups for me can be like limiting. So if I hear somebody claim one thing, it seems to sometimes suggest that you can only like operate in that area or that you're not like embracing all of like
cool
writing. So I just kind of stay like I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And kind of like embrace all of it.
So you're not like, you know, boxed in by one.
Yeah.
You know, by like, one genre. One. Yeah, that's great. I like that answer a lot. I'm going to steal that.
All right.
Somebody asked me in the gym locker room today that question. It was very weird.
Yeah.
I have a tattoo of a typewriter on my shoulder, so that's kind of why they asked.
Naturally assumed.
Yeah. Yeah. He was hoping for a screenwriter because he was trying to pitch me his World War II novel.
I see.
I like that answer. That was cool, man. All right. Here's my next and last question. Where is the strangest place you have ever come up with an idea for a poem?
Strangest place.
And strange could be a relative word. What's strange to you might not be strange to this young woman.
That's going to take a minute. I can throw out like a list of things, and one of them might be strange.
Okay.
Some of them seem normal to me. So like in the shower, okay, in the bathroom.
Sure, yeah.
Driving. Once while, I forget the exact content, but it was like some competition, like a food eating competition.
A food eating competition?
Yeah.
Like while you were participating in the food eating competition?
Yeah, like I was eating, like it was a hot dog eating, so I was eating.
You were in a hot dog eating contest.
Yeah, and it had nothing to do with hot dogs.
I am perfectly content with this answer, actually.
Is that
now.
Good? Okay.
Yeah, that's
that seems fine.
That's an amazing answer.
Normal. If I'm eating, I normally have.
But you're not just eating, you were eating in a hot dog competition.
Yeah, but that's like everyone does
everyone
that.
Everyone does that. Yeah everyone. Like, everyone partakes in a hot dog eating
that's
competition.
That's my second one of the day.
Yeah,
so.
Very few people shower. Wait, what? That was the second? Oh, no. Okay, you got me.
I'm messing with, yeah.
All right, well, I look forward to hearing your essay, man. Give it up for Faseo, everybody.
Okay, I'm going to read it from my phone. I don't know if that's crass, but... All right. So why I write. When asked why I write in the past, I've always felt pretty content saying that I simply can't not write, and that I feel compelled to, or that when I think of a perfect day, that day includes writing something down in some capacity. A poem, a short story, a couple stray lines of something indistinct. I'm glad to be able to expand on that a bit more now, because it can be really rare to be able to consider the why of why you write, and not just the how. My first forays into the world of writing came early, when I was in elementary school. I would write stories on pieces of notebook paper, and instead of paying attention in class, I would hide a book under my desk and I would read. This was pretty complicated for my teachers, because they never knew how to punish me. But the thing that strikes me when I think about this early time was the idea that I loved to write because I loved to read. I was a very wide reader, though I typically stayed with adventures and mysteries. I would read mostly anything. There was nothing like imagining, allowing myself to become lost in a work. Nothing like imagining myself in the stories I was reading. Nothing like imagining new endings to tales I loved, and even tales I didn't. And I think that this satisfaction, dissatisfaction space that writers often inhabit begins first with reading. And I find this interesting. I find it interesting how sometimes, because what you wish to see does not exist in the world, you feel compelled to create it. Because what you wish to read does not satisfy you in the ways that it should, you feel compelled to imagine the possibilities of the text in a variety of different stories. When I read to see what I have not yet seen, or what I feel would be almost impossible to see in life. I read to see the silent made strong, and the strong tremble, to see what was mighty brought low, and what was impossible made simple. I read not only to see good characterization, not only to possibly find new friends and inspirations, but to really see people. As we all know, now more than ever, it is not only important to understand who a people, but why and how a people. And so when I write, I would like to write towards those hows, and towards those possibilities, and towards fear. I would like to write in order to explore what it is that scares me, and so in the writing, give that fear a little less power. I think this draws me pretty close to my original point in that I write because I have to, because I can't not in the same way I can't not take a breath of air and can't not eat food. But since writing is a choice, I must also acknowledge that it's something I inflict upon myself. I won't stop writing. I write because I refuse not to. Thank you.
Thank you, Faseo. Coming up next, please give a warm welcome to Carla Huezo, everybody. Carla, everybody.
The new kid in school was put into the underachieving classroom. She sat bored but obedient for a few weeks until she was transferred to a more challenging atmosphere. But the sweet and smart, light-skinned Latina did not fit in. She did what any person fearing exclusion does. She began assimilating into the mainstream that surrounded her. She identified as white. She forgot her native tongue by refusing to speak it. She added blonde highlights to her dark brown hair. Those who did not actually know her believed that she was white, and between the ages of 7 and 16, I was also convinced. I spent a vast amount of time erasing and distorting experiences because I did not want to accept my multicultural background as my reality. Shame clouded many of my thoughts because all that I knew at a time was that Mexican men were trash, who abandoned their daughters or who whistled perverse calls down streets and through open car windows. I was scared of cops because I knew they could take my parents away for being different. I resented my mom and dad because they did not understand nor wanted to understand American customs. Regardless of my attempts to bury Hispanic culture, I could only avoid my reflection for so long. The first jottings on paper were apologies. I was sorry for ever wanting to be a shade lighter, a shade less dynamic. The rancor that reddened my blood was slowly washed out with each sorry I wrote. It is with writing that I realized I could not escape from this world and find myself in a fictional reality, nor could I make sense of the world made up of particles of confusion and the unknown. However, I could plug my individual lens into this outlet and observe the remarkability in being different. The act of writing helps me live through traumas I want to overcome. It is a platform on which I can stand to revisit angels lost and remember the deepest love I have felt. I do not grasp onto the constituents of a meaningful existence, but rather hold them in an open palm for those who are curious to see, read, and interpret. Too many voices belong to birds with at least one wing impaired. They want to share their melodies with the wind, but cannot fly high enough to be heard. I have tended to my wounds with words, and for this reason, I want to climb to the tops of mountains and share myself. I want those with broken wings to see that it is possible to build themselves up, but I do not want to speak for them because that would not be changing anything. It is important for a person to write a history of their own rather than have it told by someone who was not around to live it. I write as an ode to the light-skinned brown girl who forgot her beauty, but never will again. Thank you.
Up next, please give it up for Abigail Ayulo. Say what?
Ayulo.
See, this is what I... Now I just feel awkward and on the spot. Give it up for Abigail. I got that part down.
Why I write stories. Before all else, there were stories. In the deep press of the early morning, in those still 1 a.m.s, the air drips with stories. The first hour of the day, knowing there have been days before and there is a full day to come, gives that moment power. The power to create. Listen to the rustle of the sheets, to the past playing like a reel-to-reel film, to the future, a storybook wish on a faraway star. In the beginning of 1 a.m., before the morning brew and yet still coffee-stained by yesterday and 100 yesterdays, words. Before all else, there were stories, and in the afters, there will be stories, and now, in the deep press of 1 a.m., there are inevitable stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Abigail. It was so good. I got shocked when I came up here. It's electrifying. Up next, please give it up for TJ Reynolds, everybody. TJ.
Thank you, guys. Kind of awesome being here, right? A bunch of sweeties. I printed mine and then I left it. It's waiting for me there. Why I write. True stories are like feathers buried in the recesses of the body. Writing, at least for me, is the quiet art of pulling them free, quill by awful quill. And though I've dressed the cliche anew, you can see by now I'm repeating others who have summarized the process of writing. Just sit and bleed. I feel this idiom applies more to content than to the physical task. Most timeless literature involves the tragic. This is less to sell books than you might believe. What else to pass on but our greatest woes? What more to offer the next generation than the questions that haunt our dreams? Despite the back pains and neck aches involved in writing, the bleeding only comes when you decide to write the stories that have cut you in their making. I was young, a lumbering man still afraid of the strength in my hands when I found and plucked my first story feather. My mother's uterus had been removed that summer, and my father's business was failing. Worse yet, I was too naive to see the hidden but vital link between these two events. We had no money, so I worked. I learned the price of sweat. As I stood waist high in star thistle, weeding an old man's yard for 10 an hour, I was forced to stand and stretch, and I twisted side from side. But before I finished, a hot thread of pain stole down my spine. I reached a hand behind me and found the tip of a long goose feather in the small of my back. I traced the delicate outline of a perfectly wrought story, wending its way into the gaps of my vertebrae. That night, I worked it free with ink and paper. I began to meditate with words, truths, and lies. And though most of these early efforts were crude, they at least soothed the itching. I search now, eager to find them buried in the crook of an elbow or emerging as a single pink tooth from under a toenail. I try not to hesitate anymore. It costs too much to let them fester. I'm for scratching, pinching the quill between finger and thumb. I'm for honoring the pain by recording it for the world to remember. Thank you.
Thank you, TJ. This brings us to our next spotlight reader. I'm going to say their name, read their bio, and ask them to come up here and answer a few questions. Liz Harmer is a Canadian writer living in California, where she's currently pursuing her MFA in creative writing from Chapman University, just down the street. Her essays, stories, and reviews have been published widely. Oh, there's a period there. That's a short sentence. In 2014, she won a National Magazine Award for Personal Journalism and was a finalist for the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. Her first novel, The Amateurs, comes out in April from Conf Canada. Please give it up for Liz, everybody. Hey, Liz. All right, my first question for you, pretty straightforward. From reading your bio, I don't know how long you've been here in California, but I want to ask you, how is California, its geography and its culture, or hodgepodge culture, how has it informed your own writing?
I live in Riverside. I wrote my first Riverside story the first year I was here. I have to admit, it was a hostile year. I felt, I'm sorry, California, and I'm sorry, America. It was hard for me the first year. But I've grown to love it here. I miss Canada. The climate is different. This is a desert. I was by the Great Lakes. It was confusing.
I'm sure you had seasons.
We had seasons. I refused to turn the heat on. I think that year the temperature did get to about freezing. We call that zero, but you say 32, I think. And that we didn't turn the heat on because I refused to turn the heat on in California because I believed this was a tropical climate. I don't know.
Yeah. You said a Riverside story. Now, are you just saying it's a Riverside story because it was written in Riverside, or is it like actually a Riverside-themed story? Because that could be a thing.
So my husband, we came here because my husband's a philosophy professor. The story is called Never Prosper, and it's about how terrible it is to get a job in a place you don't want to move to. So.
And he's teaching philosophy.
In Riverside. Maybe not in Riverside, but that's where you resided.
You know, I love Riverside now. I'm talking. I'm saying mean things, but...
No, you're fine.
Okay.
All right, my next question's a little more tongue-in-cheek. I didn't realize I was going to have so many food questions tonight. It just happened that way. But whose bacon is better?
Oh.
Like, have we like, changed your mind on that? Or are you still...
Well, we had access to all the bacon up there, too. So.
Wait! You've taken our bacon?
Yeah.
With that, everybody, please give it up for Liz.
I'll try not to lose my voice. All right. For some reason, I decided it would be useful for me to organize this into a list of 13 points, which is, you'll see, is quite random, and at points a little repetitive, so you'll see. Number one, why I write. Number one. First, I don't know why I write. When I was a kid, I was a kid with her nose in a book, and so I was just always writing. Two, I'm worried about the world right now. Are there other things more useful to the world and its goodness than writing? My close friend Sayward, also a writer, said she wished she'd become a lawyer or a doctor so she could help. We were feeling desperate about our political situation, the feeling of its enormity and our helplessness. I told her, at least there's friendship and love. She said, art is a form of friendship. And I started to cry. Three, art is a form of friendship. Four, I had a third grade teacher who encouraged me in my writing. I went to a religious school, so one of my first writing projects was a little story I wrote from the perspective of an Egyptian girl, a young girl with no particular power, who was living through the 10 plagues brought upon them by the God of Exodus. I did not know that this was a kind of empathy. I did not know about cultural appropriation. I only know that through writing and through my imagination, I was trying to understand the world and the people in the world. Five, art is a form of friendship. Or as John Gardner says, it is for the pleasure of exercising the capacity to love that we pick up a book at all. Six, it is for the pleasure of exercising the capacity for love that I write. Seven, when I was 25 and beginning a PhD in English, I was for a variety of reasons miserable. I had no idea how to live. How was I gonna make a life? The job market was dire. I wanted to have children. I wanted to make art. How was I going to do all of that? I was also very impulsive, as you'll soon see, because then I read Mrs. Dalloway for a class. I was enthralled. I read the final line and felt a full body chill as though Virginia Woolf were breathing on my neck. Eight, I needed an epiphany and I grabbed it. There was no way to respond to how that book had made me feel in an academic context. I needed art for that. Nine, I dropped out of my PhD and got pregnant. I didn't know very much. I didn't know how much work being a parent would be. 10. I still did not know how to be a writer with any discipline. I only knew how to work in fits of inspiration. I thought I was too far behind and already a failure. I didn't know that 27 is a young age. And I didn't know at that time when I was pregnant with my second child, after having written a terrible novel and having no publications, how a person's supposed to become a writer. 11. My husband suggested I give up writing. For a month, I wasn't allowed to write or to think of myself as a writer. Thinking of myself as a writer is what I'd always done. I lasted 2 weeks. We were listening to an album. I'm going to embarrass myself by telling you the album is the soundtrack to Into the Wild by Eddie Vedder. It's a moving soundtrack. Maybe that's not embarrassing. I listened to the album and it moved me, and I didn't know what to do with my feelings except to write about them. So my husband's trick worked. Not only did I realize I needed to write, I realized I needed writing more than I needed to feel that I was a writer, the idea of which, with its pressure and its envies, was making me miserable. 12, I have never looked back. 13, in third grade, I wrote my first novel. It was a story about a family of trees, maple trees. First, they lost a family to the woodshed, then a few to disease, and the rest to a forest fire. I wrote it because I loved the maple tree in my backyard, and yes, because I'm a bit tragic, and also because I loved her. I loved that tree. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you. Keeping the show going, please give it up for Jose Jaimes.
So, why write? Writing has never been a cathartic experience, and I think I would absolutely hate it if it were. It does not serve me as a release or a pleasurable stroll into the ether of a world unknown that is just dying to get out. Writing is hard and sometimes even torturous, but at the end of the day, I know that it's mine. The words I write can only be my own. I'm not smart enough to remember anyone else's, and though the same thing may have already been written about 1,000 times over, no one says it the way I want it to be said. There's a certain vanity and self-hatred that goes into writing, and I revel in both. I write because I want to say my truth and express it in the only way I know how. Whether it hurts, it's too revealing, or just trivial, it never really matters as long as it's true. There isn't any mystique or anything left to hide. Just a raw emotion that I want to let out, and if no one else listens, then I, through my words, will. Yet, even if there is that ever sought after release, it never serves to quell anything, but instead it makes me question myself and my place even more. But words don't care. Words mean the same thing to everyone, and it is our experience that gives them life, that truly give them the power we want them to have. Whether anyone else relates or even likes my writing becomes irrelevant at the end of the day, because the truth and the words are mine. Line by line, I piece myself together, and line by line, I tear myself apart, only to continue the cycle the next time I pick up a pen. Writing is difficult. Writing is pointless. Writing is everything you'd wish you can avoid doing, yet you still do regardless, because at the end of the day, your words will always be your own, and mine remain mine because I write. Thank you.
Thank you, Jose. Up next, Jonathan Denabo. Hey, really? Nice. One for me.
Oh my God, thank you. You're so kind. Hi, I'm Jonathan. You can probably guess the title to what I'm about to read. Here goes. I began to write because I needed it. But I think I would be lying if I gave you a definite answer. I first started writing poetry in middle school or high school to cope with my mental illness and figure myself out. In using the words figure, I will invoke three meanings. The first would be the verb, to make a shape of. The second, of a shape that is too far and indistinct. And the third would be of the shape of someone's body. This is to say that, principally, writing has been a way for me to make a shape of something that may seem too far or indistinct. And in figuring something else out, I discover my body, myself. Writing has allowed me to discover what is distant, near, immediate, personal, intimate, loved, loving, love, hurtful, hurting, hurt. When I explain what I mean, I like to start from big to little or little to big. But before I go on, I will look to Leibniz for a bit of philosophy on reflective acts. Reflective acts, which cause us to think of what is called the I and to decide that this or that is within us. In thinking about ourselves, we think of being, substance, of the simple and the composite, of a material thing and of God. Thus, and that's the end of the quote, this is me now. Thus, when reflecting, when thinking about and expressing ourselves, we consider and express the whole universe. I am so little, so I write for the metaphor, to make relationships and figure myself, to feel full, to figure my shape and fill it with the universe, to explain what I mean, to realize that in expressing who I am and discovering whether I'm this or that, I start to build connections with the world around me. I write for the I, the ego, to have a trace in everything and allow everything to have a trace in me, and then to figure myself again and again and again. Reconfiguration is the most fun part of writing. Today I write for the universe, and tomorrow I will abandon all this Leibnizian and Derridian philosophy and write about gum and dirt in the attic. I will forget that gum is expressing some distant truth, and I will write because, well, gum. And I have seen writing that assumes control of language, but I've realized that when writing, I let language come to me. In a stupid sense, I don't realize meaning until after I have expressed it. When sharing my writing, I have a mentor that always tells me, you have to think of what gift this poem is giving. Writing here is a way of giving to the universe and allowing the universe to give to you. Writing poetry is a way to mean with and in the vast universe. And my eye is so little, all it can try to do is mean. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Up next, it is a pleasure. You heard her speak a little bit in the beginning. Our host for the evening, not to be confused with moderator, is Sarah Guerrero. And let me tell you just a little bit about her. She's earned herself a bio because she is your host. She is a Southern California native. She's the founding artistic director of the award-winning Santa Ana-based Breath of Fire Latina Theater Ensemble and has been recognized as one of the people to watch by American Theater Magazine and Best Artistic Director and Person of Interest by OC Weekly. A Cal Arts alum, awesome, Guerrero is a professional, versatile theater artist whose mission is to model, share, and create theater-making opportunities for and with her community. Give it up for Sarah, everybody.
It's Guerrero. It rhymes with Camaro, if that helps. No, it's okay. It's okay. Okay. When I was a little girl, I asked my dad, do you have a wee-wee?
A wee-wee?
Yes, a wee-wee.
¿Cómo es un wee-wee?
He laughed. We don't call our pinchy elbows pointy things. Mija, you have a vagina. I have a penis, and the rest of the world can fuck themselves. My dad then took out a number of books with vivid pictures and illustrations, and I learned all in an afternoon about the human reproductive system. Oh, with my newfound knowledge, I was set on educating the world! After my educational crusade, most of the kids in the neighborhood weren't allowed to play with me. Who needs friends? I had my dad's books. I was more interested in my anatomy. I was looking forward to watching the grass grow on the field. I so desperately wanted hair on my vagina. They look so unfinished without it, right? What an odd, crooked smile. I had an idea. My mom had just got done brushing my sister's hair. That was quite an ordeal. You see, my sister has curly, 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 curly hair. And our mom would buy only shampoo and no conditioner. I, having straight hair, painful. But my sister, ay, pobrecita, with her curly, 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 curly hair, it would be excruciatingly pulled and yanked by this horrible, monstrous, pink Pepto-Bismol bristly brush with Avon etched on the handle. That thing was evil. Between my sister's screams, pleads, and cries,
My mom would detangle the mess into puffy mushroom clouds, postmodern topiaries, and dust bunnies, which inevitably left large clumps of hair on the bristles of the pink monster. The day my sister found conditioner and mousse, it was like discovering Mecca. Hallelujah. Praise Paul Mitchell and pass the frizz control. Seeing that my sister was down for her post-brushing cry, my mom was next in the shower. And I was alone. I took that devil brush. I quickly pulled the tangled dark brown clumps of hair from its bristles. I examined it carefully. And I began to gently tuck the hair between the folds of my crooked smile. Carefully arranging it so. And while standing before a mirror, I was amazed by my transformation. I was a woman. I saw into the future, and I could hear my song playing right outside the window. Danger in the shape of something wild. Stranger dressed in black, she's a hungry child. Hot child in the city. Hot child in the city. Running wild and looking pretty. Hot child in the city, yeah. I don't know how long I had been dancing in the mirror when I caught a glimpse of my sister's mushroom reflection. Shit. I dropped the devil brush and my vagina toupee fell to the floor. My sister held it over my head, blackmailing me for most of my childhood. You ask her now, and she doesn't remember. Thank you.
Give up for Sarah. And I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I am going to say it because I never thought I'd have the opportunity. And her vagina toupee. Wow. I good luck, whoever goes next. Good luck. And that person is, drum roll, please, give up for Corin Reburn, everybody. Corin. Am I saying it somewhat right? Oh, okay, for the first name I got right. All right.
Hi, I'm Corin Reburn. I'm a novel and short story writer, and I don't feel good about following that. But here it goes. So I originally drafted this essay a few years ago, and looking back at it now, I'm surprised by how much the reasons why I write have changed. So I'd like to read part of the original essay and then take a look at how I'd answer the question why I write today. So this is part of what I wrote initially. I'm someone who writes because I have to, because I can't imagine not writing. The satisfaction I get from writing is one I find nowhere else. There are many common reasons for writing: the need for expression, for attention, for distraction, the desire to entertain ourselves and others. The key word here is need. We write because we need to. I write to convince myself that my time is not wasted, that I am creating something which, just maybe, will jettison off into the world and spark change. At its core, I write because I sometimes feel there's little I can do to change the world. Within my own worlds, however, Pleasures are sustainable. Uprisings are successful. The evil corporate tycoon gets his comeuppance. The bad guy loses. Or does he? If I'm writing about a world that reflects our own, happy endings may be hard to come by. But writing allows me to taunt reality, to turn the dial up to 11 in an attempt to demonstrate the absurdity of our own world. I write both to escape and to condemn. So that's an excerpt from the initial essay. When this event came up, I revisited the topic and realized my motivations today are a little bit different. I write because the world is full of things unseen, and by putting them on the page, they become visible. The idea becomes form, the illusion becomes reality, the dream is realized. Yes, I also still write as a way to process pain, but I also write to process joy. I write because I want to connect, because I want to share something with many someones and have them share with me. Because I know that when I read something that resonates with me, I feel connected. I realize I'm not alone. These days I write with a sense of ease, with a confidence that no, my time is not wasted. Nothing is wasted when you are creating and connecting. Though writing so often feels like an isolated process, it has also connected me to so many people. Many of my dearest friends are writers, and our mutual support of one another is reason enough to do this. The writing community I am privileged to be a part of, that extends across the country, beyond the page, beyond the limits of our bodies, answers the question why. For the goal is not to escape into lonely worlds where you are the sole occupant. It's to build a home limited by nothing where all can thrive, and to invite anyone and everyone to stay as long as they want. Thank you.
Thanks, Corin. Up next, please give a welcome to Brian Lynn. Brian Lynn, come on down.
I feel oddly connected to a lot of the pieces that people have read. I feel like I can hear and see myself in what people have shared so far. So can we give a round of applause for everybody, please? So on to my piece. Can you raise your hand if you've been in a writing workshop or a writing group of some sort? Okay, and keep your hand up if you've taken feedback personally when you know you shouldn't and you still talk about it to this day. I'm petty like that too. Okay, so this is for us. It's also about the body and how we write. I was wired by white worlds, the Midwest and the Ivy League. Fat, Asian, and queer, I feared sight as judgment. Abercrombie was the norm, I was Nightcrawler. An immigrant too, my every word held the threat of mistake. I feared more than misunderstanding, I doubted I would ever come across. Thus, I learned to observe, not act. Listen, not speak. Hide, not seek. I didn't meet another gay Asian man until my last year of college. I've seen myself reflected on screen only once, on an international flight, nowhere. You live this way long enough, you end up believing two things. One, that you're anomalous, outside understanding. Two, that you're exceptional, the only one deserving of sight. In this body, recognition was unthinkable and desire impossible. I learned from David Foster Wallace that the problem with living was loneliness. When he hanged himself on my birthday, I wanted to believe that a cosmic shift made me heir to his genius. Genius exempts you from the duties of communication, namely understanding of self and clarity of presentation. Works of genius get to be inscrutable. By definition, they are out of our lay line of sight. An easy read of Wallace is that he wrote to be looked at, not to be seen. My body wasn't ready for either, much less both. I fear for my writing as I did for my body. My question is always, does this make sense? After workshops, my writing always feels illegible, its themes unspeakable. When the workshop is all white, I say that they are blind. When the workshop is my people, I tell myself they're too simple. All these workshops, it turns out, were more for me than my work. I looked for people to tell me I was worthy. If only a stranger would say I was a genius, I would finally be enough. My body, afraid, worked for style more than story. I trusted only brief attention. Looking can turn into seeing, and my body was not for sight. I had read so much Wallace, I didn't think I needed story. He's known for his sentences, so smart, so long, mine turned heads. Thing is, I was trying to break hearts. I wanted people to see the world in my writing, but what I had really worked on was my words. So I learned, style makes people look, but only for so long. Story makes people see, which can take all the time in the world. I don't see myself as fat anymore. I fear attention less. I feel less shame when I look at myself. I hold my body as worthy. As I shapeshift, vulnerability changes from condition to choice. I choose these days to speak as deeply as I listen. I am learning to tell stories. I shed the armor of style. I assemble its shards into bridge. Across the way, I see people I can hardly yet imagine looking back at me. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Up next, another spotlight reader. Julie Schult is the fiction editor at Faultline Journal of Arts and Letters. She has ghost-written memoirs, and her essay on handbags, memory, and shame was included in the Atlantic's Object Lesson series. She's a recent graduate of University of California Irvine's MFA program in writing, and she is finishing a novel. Please give it up for Julie, everybody. What is the first book that you remember reading that you kind of had that like light bulb epiphany moment that's like, hey, I want to do this?
That's a difficult question. It's not the first one I remember thinking that, but I think The Tin Drum, if anyone has read that, I remember thinking how strange that you could write a paragraph about your grandmother's skirts and like a whole world under them. And also, you know, he's so demented and confused. So I really liked that one. I read it quite young.
Okay. And like that, like you see that kind of like left that impact on you. That's like, I want to be a writer.
I liked the idea that he could do what he wanted. And he, you know, he pretended he was this little boy. It was very strange.
Perfect answer. Yeah. That was awesome. See, it wasn't so bad.
No.
Okay. So this next question is how much is too much to spend on a handbag?
I think it depends on the person. I think...
For you personally.
For me personally, yeah. I've never spent more than like $100 on a handbag,
okay.
Which is why I loved writing that piece, because people were spending like $300,000 or on these handbags, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
That tells me everything that I need to know.
Yeah, and I'm more interested in what people do with the handbags, or why they wanted them, or... also what they had to do to get them is very interesting.
And on that note, we look forward to hearing what you have to present. Thank you.
Okay. Writing is my most terrifying desire on the best days and my most pestering necessity on the worst. I would agree with Anais Nin when she claims that for her, it is nothing short of a matter of life and death. I believe that one writes because one has to create a world in which one can live. I could not live in any of the worlds offered to me, the world of my parents, the world of war, the world of politics. I had to create a world of my own, like a climate, a country, an atmosphere in which I could breathe, reign, and recreate myself when destroyed by living. That's a quote. Nin elegantly reveals what calls us to writing, that innate hunger for more than what is presented to us. But somehow this explanation seems inadequate. This world suggests a refuge, a space for something very precious that one has created. This atmosphere seems to me an ethereal armor against living, and yet writing itself can seem so arduous. Anyone who's taken up this task might wonder why one retreats from imminent destruction only to destroy herself more. Why would she isolate to give up life? There are endless reasons not to write. The sickening vulnerability that what we contain will be exposed on the page, the sheer intimidation of one's predecessors peeking from the bookshelves. is enough to toss down the pen. If we recall Eliot's tradition in the individual talent, we might even feel that our worst sentences are polluting the canon before they've even been written. But I write towards living. In The Passion, according to G.H. by Lispector, the speaker says, I had reached the nothing, and the nothing was living and moist. I am writing past everything I know to some place of gestation, to the heart of life itself. If Mark Rothko paints large in order to be intimate, I write long sentences in order to do the same. I write long sentences towards an unpredictable place to allow for an alchemy with my reader. I may sit down at my desk intending to tell the story of a seamstress or capture the absurdity of a child chasing a goose while a couple's relationship unravels. I may want my readers to feel lighter or touched or ripped to shreds with every winding sentence, but I proceed knowing that the effect is beyond my control. All I can do is call to you, my reader, with everything I have. This thought comes from Sisu, who says in her essay, The Last Painting, that as a writer, she is a being who paints mimosas by phone. I gather words to make a great straw yellow fire, but if you don't put in your own flame, my fire won't take. My words won't burst into pale yellow sparks. My words will remain dead words. Without your breath on my words, there will be no mimosas. Mimosas are flowers, not just drinks. I too write to live. I write towards a life that only my readers can resurrect. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Up next, please welcome Elias Fulmer, everybody. Elias, come on down.
Well, I haven't gotten that one before, but I'll take it. Elias. Thank you guys for coming out. I tend to alienate audiences when I try to introduce myself too long, so I don't think there's anything else but just get right into it. Words such as painter, musician, teacher, etc., can easily box individuals into the stereotypes of these life paths as perceived by others. If a conversation I introduce in the fact I read, people may ask me, do you write? Suddenly I feel a bit cornered. I feel a pen appear in my hand, dusty, antiquated clothes surface on me, topped with a powdered wig. Saying anything but yes is reductive. Most people around the world can read and write. The presence of social media continues to render such irrelevant. No matter how odious or delightful that you perceive of it, it actually works to increase literacy. Recent UNESCO reports tell us that 86.3% of people above the age of 15 are able to read and write. It is not a triumph of magic as to how anyone writes. Now, as to why I write, why anyone writes is a different question. Before I knew how to read or write, I was very concerned with storytelling. I was born and raised at the height of VHS tapes and the emergence of the internet. From an early age, I became intensely involved in the worlds that I found in the television shows, movies, and books I was exposed to. Before the age of 5 or 6, there's such an indubitable marriage of imagination and reality for young children. Our environments are very much influenced by our peripheral surroundings, and I chose to engage myself as far as I could reach within the worlds that I loved. Those early memories are part of me as though I am in make-believe. The media environments I had experienced at a young age have really impacted me. When I came of age to read and took to it voraciously at school, I approached writing. Friendship was a big question mark for me when I was very young, so it was easier for me to divest attention into my own mind. While lonely, I had the odd ritual of whispering myself stories. Later, I learned it's best to plot them in my head. While social aspects of school were hard for me to grasp before high school, I had the graces of some very good teachers across different subjects. Many of them encouraged me to write. I don't do it because they told me to. There's many other pieces of advice they told me I did not follow. I write because words are the atoms of communication. I love to see them race around, split up, explode, and evolve. I write because I'm concerned with the development of new ideas and the digging up of old ones, too. Some of them. Today, writing and particularly journalism, is being nefariously abused, as the cycles of the past show us. An unholy saturation in and of writing, particularly in online print, that seeks to reduce writing simply as a tool to reinforce the drudgery of life and maximize media profits. I write to enrich life, my own and others. We must reclaim writing for human richness. Thank you.
All right, I'm not gonna take the blame on that one. My brother-in-law tells me his name is Elias. And so I blame him, and I'm gonna have a long talk with him. Thank you. Our next reader is Christy Tate, everybody. Christy, come on down here. Hey, there you are, Christy.
When I was a young child, my mother would take me to the library, and she would leave me in the children's department while she went to collect her own books. And my mother hated Dr. Seuss, but I really liked Dr. Seuss. And so I would read, I would spend my time with The Cat in the Hat and Horton and all of those wonderful characters. But then when my mom would come, I would tuck the books under other books and pretend like I was not reading Dr. Seuss, because she hated Dr. Seuss and I was not allowed to check the books out because she didn't want to read them to me. Years passed, and my mother got sick, and I lived alone with my mother and my father, and my mother had cancer, and she was bedridden for many years. And during that time, a woman from our church would bring my mom a box of romance novels, and she would put them by my mom's bed. And my mom didn't know it, but I read all of those books too. And it was just like Dr. Seuss all over again, but a lot sexier. Now I have it. When my mom grew, reading became my escape from a very horrific and scary situation. Immersed in a story, I didn't have to think about the life and death drama taking place on the other side of my bedroom wall. And books are my hallucinogenic drug of choice. In college, I studied literature and fell in love with Eliot and Willa and too many others to mention. This had no similarity to my dating life. I am no longer a child living with a grieving father and a dying mother, nor am I a co-ed in search of something or someone real, nonfiction. I am an adult, blessed with an abundance of love. I love God, I love my husband, I love our children, my dog, my friends, my neighbors, my writing group, the birds outside my window. Because I'm a writer, I also love my characters. I adore their pluck and courage and mettle, and I admire the way they face and overcome hardships. But as in any relationship, sometimes I get angry with them and think that they are too stupid to live. At these times, I have to remind myself that they exist only in my imagination unless I share them. Writing for me is all about sharing, giving back to the world that has so generously blessed me. I learned a long time ago that the world is full of life and death dramas, and sometimes we need a story to escape. And most of us won't be fortunate enough to have a church lady deliver us a big box of romance. We have to seek out our own entertainment. And in today's world, we are bombarded with so many ways to fill our time and to divert our attention. But books never run out of batteries. We can go to the library, or if you have a tablet or a computer, you can go online. And there are thousands of stories to choose from, and many of them are free. Books introduce us to unknown worlds, courageous thinking, and different points of view. Sometimes I get caught up in the creation of a story and the pleasure is all mine. But when the slogging is hard, when the words won't come, when the characters are wooden and boring, I remember my younger self, my dying mother and my grieving father, and I write. Not because I enjoy it, but because someone somewhere might need to escape into a story.
So, our final reader of the evening, Nick Maurer. Yeah? Yeah, I'm getting the, at least I went out good. I went out strong with that one. He is the current poetry editor of Faultline Journal of Arts and Letters. He is a writer and visual artist working in Southern California. Previous work has been published in McSweeney's, Orangelandia, The Literature of Inland Citrus, and other journals. Come on down, join me up here on stage, would you?
You're doing a great job, by the way.
Thank you so
yeah,
much, Nick.
Killing it, yeah.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
Do you do this professionally, or?
Do I professionally butcher people's names? Absolutely. Yeah.
You do performance poetry? Is that?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I did.
I thought that's what I heard.
Wait, I'm supposed to ask the questions.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I started off in like the performance realm and stuff like that. But I host readings and stuff like things like that. You can find out more about me after the show. Buy me a drink. All right. So here are my questions for you, sir.
All right.
Let's start off with this one. So it says in your bio that you're also a visual artist.
Yeah.
How, and a lot of the writers here work in various other forms of the written word, but you're the first person in their bio mentions that you do something of a different artistic medium as well. How is it going from the writing to the visual? Like, what's that process like for you?
Oh, interesting question. Yeah. I had a teacher once tell me that writing and visual art, writing and painting, it's all the same thing. And so that sort of stuck with me, I think.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think he said that, or what reason do you allow that to stick? Like,
I think it's because he said it in such an off-the-cuff manner, like, I don't know, so blasé, just, oh, it's all the same thing. And I thought, oh, maybe it is all the same thing. But yeah, I do visual art. I paint. I do digital works, like sculptural poems too. So it is informed by writing.
Cool.
The visual stuff I do, but yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So because someone told you so, that's why. Gotcha.
Yep. You got me.
All right. Here's this last question. So the last thing that you wrote, like a big fear that I have as a writer is like, thinking like that, like creative spark, that like magic ghost inside of you just decides to leave one day and you're left with the very last thing that you wrote as it.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I'm just like setting up.
Oh, okay.
Sir. So here's the question. If the last thing that you wrote was it, like the ghost of creativity living inside your soul, just decided to just hitchhike out of there.
This is
and you were
dark.
Left with the last thing. What?
They said, this is dark.
You said, I can go anywhere with this.
All right,
so I'm
all
going.
Right. All right, let's do it.
The last thing that you wrote, do you feel that it would definitely define your journey, or would it be like a dirty joke haiku?
Dirty joke haiku. So I have two options.
Well, I mean, somewhere between that. Would it define your journey? Would you be happy with the last, like where you are? Like, does it define your journey?
Dirty?
I saved my deepest question for the last question of the night, people.
I mean, dirty joke haiku. I'm happy with that.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's a great answer.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Nick, it was a pleasure.
All right. Hey.
Look
Thanks,
forward to
Eric.
Reading.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Hey, well, it's an honor to be wrapping up this incredible night of readings, a marathon of readings, really. So many great stories. So many great stories. I realize my essay is a little bit more conceptual, but maybe all that means is that it has to do with the story of the mind. But I don't know, maybe not. Okay, it starts with the essay starts with a quote. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. This first sentence of Joan Didion's essay, The White Album, ignites her investigation of the social unraveling of American society in the 1960s, an unraveling that parallels her own psyche. There is something about a good beginning, the immediate impact of it, similar to the moment your eye first glimpses a vast abstract painting that is formative of the entire experience of reading that follows. It is perhaps the most visible part of a piece of writing, the beginning. Much writing has to do with persuasion, a fundamental part of language, if you consider what the first conversation must have been like. This is a chair. No, this is a surface. No, this is a piece of writing. I write because I'm interested in what others say, to discover how a thing can be said. Could one make an essay entirely of first sentences, perhaps from other wonderful essays in this series? Poetry is about discovering what is possible. It enhances the quality of visibility afforded by other media, develops a sense of self, identity, and authenticity, and in doing so, of togetherness, belonging, and purpose. It is always a social act. You can do what you want in poetry, but everything matters, a notion that rings true of life. Communication is always a risk. Misunderstanding is inevitable. Poetry allows for misunderstanding and misreading, even encourages it. Much like our dreams, the poet dreams awake, editing the creative rush to host an event in language for the listener. Newness is in the act of saying. Poems want to be uttered. Art is a conversation, says conceptual artist Lawrence Weiner, who often deploys text poetically. If not, what the hell is it for? On the one hand, writing can be ambiguous, playful, arcane, passive, descriptive. On the other hand, it can be clear, concise, colloquial, active, prescriptive, or any combination of adjectives. The qualities listed here are not necessarily opposing qualities. We humans have two hands, but the hands to which I refer in the rhetorical phrasing of the previous sentences might belong to an eight-armed Martian or an octopus with hands. Now let me conclude with several striking first sentences. Leche, I hear against an auditory backdrop of my mom's preparations for Mexican-style rice, crackling onions, tomatoes, and garlic. When something has been a part of me for so long, it is hard to imagine myself without it. I can't stop writing about the end of the world. On an island of white privilege at the foot of the Golden Gate Bridge, I raised a boy of color. If you were to look up the definition of rough childhood in the dictionary, you might see a picture of me. Sometimes you hear a voice through the door calling you, as a fish out of water hears the waves, or a hunting falcon hears the drums come back. Running and writing have always felt the same to me. I write comedy. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. I'm sorry, I'm a liar. There's one more person. We didn't think they were gonna make it, but they did, and we're so happy that they're here, so we're gonna bring up one final reader of the evening. Please give it up for Rebecca LaRoe, everyone. Rebecca.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to start with saying if you hear a grumbling noise, that's my stomach. I'm a little hungry. I also wanted to say thank you to 1888 and my family, and I'm grateful for this opportunity, and thank you to God. So, why I write. It had begun like it always did. There were the early stretches of light across the sky, and I was there, waiting. In this moment, a requiem in crescendo recalled nostalgic memories. It had begun, the process of pain, devastation, and denial. It was the same in its callousness, but it was deeper. It was different in its depths. These wounds were deeper and heavier. They dragged and writhed into incongruent lines upon my mind, and they were reinforced again and again by every thought of you and how I miss you. They are reinforced with every ounce of blood that pulses through my body. They say the more often you recall a memory, the less accurate it is. And this is the scariest thing to know and the hardest thing to avoid. I've stored up every memory of you, and every time it's about to play in my head, I stop it and save it for a day I may really need it, because you are art to me. I want to remember as many details of you as I can. The way you laugh, and the way you would wrap your arms around me. I've written down our memories so I can try to preserve them as accurate as I can. It was summer break and I was spending time with her, my aunt. It wasn't glorious. As a matter of fact, it was rather ordinary. We started our summer morning the way we always had. 8-year-old me would help her make breakfast and hot chocolate. Then we'd watch one of her favorite movies. We'd both sit there reciting the lines to the tittle. Words have power. I learned this by watching her laugh and cry by the words delivered through the screen. And that's when I started writing. I wrote in my first journal all my adventures with my favorite person in the world, her. She's gone now, and all I have are these words to try to encompass all of who she was. And started with her, to keep her alive inside my mind and permanent with words to a page. But now I write to keep alive the feelings, thoughts, and painted sensations that encompass each new encounter I have. I write to bring to life those dead or dying parts within myself or others. Words on a page are like a mirror to the soul, to which I truly believe that our words are inextricable from our personhood. Though gesture and gift can be expressions by which one shows love, for the writer, there is no greater reflection than that of words. I write because I love, I hurt, I fear, and I overcome. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Let's give a round of applause to all of our writers and our readers for tonight. And I just like to stress again how wonderful it is to have spaces like this. 1888 Center. If you want to continue to see these things or have these opportunities, I know that 1888 is a nonprofit, a 501c3. So if not today, drop a few dollars, PayPal, visit their website. Continue to support local spaces like these. Whatever, a dollar may not seem a lot, but it can make a difference. I, who live in the nonprofit world, appreciate donations. So please take a little time and drop a donation. Again, I'd love to thank, let me look at my list, sorry. Brew Sessions Live, thank you. Woo! Contra Coffee and Tea, yeah. This wonderful culminating event of the Roadshow. And I'd like to leave you with a little something. I'd like to leave you with a little thought. You know, what you write, it was beautiful to be a part of this and to hear what people wrote, right? And now what you write, as I had the pleasure of working with Cherie Moraga, who is a poet and a playwright, and she had mentioned to me how it's an offering. And I want to thank you for your offerings tonight, and I hope you continue to create your offerings. So thank you. Enjoy your evening and support storytelling. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the 1888 Center podcast. Support our mission by subscribing, reviewing, or donating today. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and Trevor Allred. Our music is composed and performed by Dan Record. Visit us in Old Town Orange, California, or online at 1888.center.